Hello, everyone. This is Kate Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post, sharing the lamp of experience. In this age of short memories and even shorter attention spans, echo chambers, and tweeting in all caps, it is the responsibility of older Americans to teach the young why our nation's history and traditions still matter. This is written by Joanne C. Jenkins and Mitchell B. Rice. I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know of no way of judging of the future but by the past. That was written by Patrick Henry. These aren't the most famous lines that Patrick Henry delivered in St. John's Church on March 23, 1775, but with this speech, better known for his saying, "Give me liberty or give me death," America's founding firebrand invoked the power of history to light the fledgling nation's way towards a better future. Henry had captured an essential truth with ancient roots. Study the past if you would divine the future, Confucius had said centuries earlier. Today, a paraphrase of that maxim looms large in the heart of our nation's capital, carved into the bases of two 65-ton statues titled Past and Future. The former represented in the form of an elder man, the latter as a young woman seated outside the National Archives of Pennsylvania Avenue. Understanding our past is no less critical now than it was in Henry's time to building a better future for America. We would argue, in fact, it is all the more so given the ever-increasing pace of change in social, political, and cultural affairs and the thick webs of connectivity linking communities and individuals today. Yet that fundamental knowledge of our nation's story, of our founding principles, and our common national inheritance is increasingly hard to come by. This past February, results from a Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation survey revealed that only 4 in 10 Americans, and significantly fewer among those under age 45, could pass a basic test of American history. Just 15% knew when the U.S. Constitution was written. Less than a third could correctly identify 3 of the original 13 states. Roughly 40% thought Benjamin Franklin invented the light bulb. Sadly, these results were not outliers. Most Americans cannot name the 3 branches of government. According to findings from the Annenberg Public Policy Center, more than a third cannot name 1 right guaranteed under the First Amendment. The news about younger Americans is even more alarming, although not exactly surprising. For years, our national zeal for more technical STEM-centered instruction, coupled with an increasing reliance on standardized testing, has driven social studies out of the classroom. Consequently, kids aren't learning much of it. The last results of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP, revealed that 29% of American 8th graders demonstrated below basic knowledge of U.S. history. Another 53% fell into the basic knowledge category, with just 18% registering proficient or better. And the story doesn't get much better when our young people go on to college. In December 2016, George Washington University in Washington, D.C., announced that history majors are no longer required to take a single course on American history to graduate. This in a university that is named after our first president and located in our nation's capital. This begs the question, if the youngest generations of Americans grow up lacking a basic understanding of the past, ignorant and unaware of the essential beliefs which have guided our nation for nearly 3 centuries, What kind of nation will we be in 10, 20, or even 100 years from now? What kind of leaders will we produce? What kind of nation will we be leaving to future generations of Americans? Former President Harry S. Truman wrote in his memoirs, "My debt to history is one which cannot be calculated. I know of no other motivation which so accounts for my awakening interest as a young lad in the principles of leadership and government." When the last results of the history NAEP were released, Michelle Herzog, then president of the National Council for the Social Studies, put it another way. Why is this important? The representative democracy established by our founding fathers calls for all members of society to be represented in legislatures, political offices, jury boxes, and voting booths. Unfortunately, this vision has yet to be realized. How do we, as a nation, maintain our status in the world if future generations of Americans do not understand our nation's history, world geography, or civic principles and practices? She asked. How indeed? The simple truth is, we cannot. It doesn't have to be this way. Older Americans, however, can help change this narrative by meeting younger generations at the crossroads of America's history, up close and in person. But what better way to understand the foundations of our democracy than to visit Colonial Williamsburg, Independence Hall, the National Archives, Plymouth Rock, the Old North Church, or Ellis Island? What better way to understand our presidents than to visit Mount Vernon, Monticello, Mount Rushmore, or the many presidential homes and libraries across the country? What better way to understand the sacrifices ordinary men and women have made over the years to defend our democracy than by visiting Gettysburg, Bunker Hill, Yorktown, Valley Forge, Appomattox, Fort Henry, the Alamo, Pearl Harbor, Little Bighorn, Battlefield, the Vietnam Memorial, Arlington National Cemetery, the Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site, or the 9/11 Memorial and Museum? What better way to understand how inventors and great inventions have contributed to and changed our cultural and way of life than to visit Kitty Hawk, Golden Spike, the Henry Ford Museum, the Kennedy Space Center, Hoover Dam, or the National Air and Space Museum? What better way to understand the impact of social movements on our nation and our people than to visit the National Museum of African American History, the National Museum of the American Indian, the National Historic Park in Seneca Falls, the GLBT History Museum in San Francisco, or the Rosa Parks Museum? And what better way to understand the roots of our popular culture than by visiting the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Grand Old Opry, the Autry Museum of American West, the Cherokee Heritage Center, Falling Water, or the various film, art, television, radio, and sports museums located throughout the country? Sharing these experiences is what brings history to life. It helps us understand and appreciate who we are and where we are today. Most importantly, it inspires us to build on that history to create a better and brighter tomorrow for future generations. In this age of short memories and even shorter attention spans, echo chambers, and tweeting in all caps, there remain thousands of opportunities for older and younger Americans to turn away from the noise and to reconnect with places where Americans fought for our freedom, found their inspirations, shaped our culture, and forged our most precious guiding principles. By visiting the places where so much has been won, lost, and learned, America's youth can begin to understand who we are as a people and what kind of future we want to build for ourselves. Why ask older America to lead this charge? It's not because everyone over the age of 50 is a scholar of U.S. history. We don't all remember every word of the Gettysburg Address. And we can't all recite details about the Louisiana Purchase or the French and Indian War. But many of us did absorb much of our knowledge of American history at a time when learning history was a more valued endeavor in our schools, home, and culture at large. Throughout the age, older people have served as our keepers of the culture. As the late Dr. Gene Cohen, a renowned psychiatrist and expert on creativity and aging, has pointed out, transmitting a lifetime of knowledge and experience from an older person to a younger one can inspire dreams, create careers, spur innovation, and provide a fulfilling life. As our nation struggles to find a common purpose, and a national identity, a journey to rediscover our American roots can be a means to our coming together to envision and build a better America for our children and grandchildren and future generations. Trekking to hallowed historic ground was once a considered equal parts education, recreation, and civic duty. Visitation numbers don't lie. In past decades, most school groups and families spent considerably more time and resources touring battlefields and presidents' homes, historic halls of government, history museums, and ancient harbors and farms. It was part of our collective coming of age and, as a result, baked into our collective American identity. It was our shared national inheritance. Consider, by contrast, the experiences of Generation Z, born roughly between 1995 and 2010. Studies shown this younger generation feels unmoored from our nation's defining institutions, which they tend not to trust. And like the millennials who preceded them, only a fraction self-identify as patriotic, 15%, in stark comparison to their elders. That's according to a 2017 study by 747 Insights, a firm specializing in multi-generational research. Now more than ever, young Americans need the chance to rediscover their country and find their place in history. They deserve to hold history in their own hands, feel its pulse beneath their feet. At birthplaces, workplaces, and family homes of presidents and generals, artists, activists, and inventors, and the millions of Americans who were enslaved. At sites of military battles and of protest for political and social change. At these crossroads of past and present, grandparents, great uncles, aunts, and others can share with younger generations what they have lived and seen of America's story, what they know and were taught of it themselves, and why it still matters. They can inspire a deeper understanding of and interest in our history. And in the process, they may renew and expand their own. Older Americans share the lamp of experience because they have a burning desire to leave the world a better place than they found it. They also see the value in connecting the generations to build stronger intergenerational relationships. Taking younger family members or volunteering to accompany other children on school or church trips, for example, to visit historical sites achieves both of these purposes, while helping to rekindle all-American sense of national identity. It not only helps strengthen our connections with one another, it gives younger generations a greater appreciation for our national motto, E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, one. In his book, How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations, Mark Friedman points out that, despite all the negative headlines, surveys reveal an extraordinary degree of mutual respect, most especially between boomers and millennials. And an overwhelming majority of older people say that the opportunity for future generations to prosper is important or very important to achieving America's promise. We're witnessing an incipient movement today of older people who are connecting with younger ones, standing up and showing up for the next generation, and resisting the mandate to go off in pursuit of their own second childhood. So, at a time when there are more Americans over 50 than under 18 for the first time in history, the timing couldn't be better. We too believe strongly in connections across the generations and in the power of historic places because, in our respective lines of work, we witness their impacts every day. This is a potent formula for change that we feel an urgency to share. For if we do not reverse our collective downward spiral into historical and cultural amnesia, our nation and everything for which it has traditionally stood will pay a very high price. We believe, in fact, we are seeing the effects already. According to the last World Values Survey results published in the National Journal of Democracy, almost three-quarters of those born before World War II considered it absolutely important to live in a democratically governed country. Just 30% of millennials, those born since 1980, felt that way. If this is not a long-term threat, we're not sure what is. But there is hope. By visiting the past together, we come face to face with America as it was. In so doing, we can truly understand how far we have come and imagine still how far we can go. We owe it to our younger generations and ourselves to take this journey together. The possibilities stretch from sea to shining sea, from Ellis Island to Pearl Harbor. Events and movements have unfolded across every part of our landscape that continue to impact our world today. Take your grandchildren to the Susan B. Anthony House in Rochester, New York, and stand in the very room where the suffragette was arrested in 1872 just for casting a vote. Or head south with the family to the restored lunch counter at the original Woolworth's building in Greensboro, North Carolina, where a 1960 sit-in catalyzed a protest movement across 20 states involving 70,000 people. Try following the Trail of Tears National Historic Trail, stopping at memorials and museums along the way. As you cross any or all of the 9 states and thousands of miles and trail covers, consider together the sheer magnitude of America's mass relocation of Cherokee and other tribes during the 1830s, its injustice and the devastation it wrought, killing thousands in the process. These are complex stories, yet they reverberate through time the impact our lives. By going to the source to see, hear, and touch this history together, where it actually took place, we personalize and deepen our understanding. Thomas Jefferson believed that an educated citizenry was essential to the preservation of American democracy. He argued that we can't expect people to fight to preserve American democratic principles if they can't define what they are. Without historical perspective and knowledge of how people lived, the sacrifices they made for our country, and how our institutions evolved, people have no basis for making rational decisions about the country. We urge you to share your lamp of experience. It's a first important step. We owe it to them, to ourselves, and to future generations to take it together. Joanne C. Jenkins is CEO of AARP. Michelle B. Reese is President and CEO of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. The Accidental Beekeeper: How a Self-Described City Slicker, who used to sweat at anything buzzy, learned to love and appreciate the honeybee. This is written by Cheney Kwok. As the mild San Francisco morning sun fills the back of my station wagon, I wrestle with two stacked boxes buzzing with a low hum. I can't afford to slip or drop them. Inside is a colony of honeybees. Until recently, I was a helpless city slicker, prone to startling and swatting at anything buzzy. I couldn't even tell a bright yellow jacket from a striped honeybee. Yet here I am, veiled and covered up, hugging two supers, wooden boxes, making up a hive, full of bees, wax, and honey. I'm now one of many amateur beekeepers fostering the winged creatures in urban and suburban communities around the country. Numbers vary widely from study to study, some citing upwards of 120,000 Americans looking after honeybees on rooftops and in backyards. There may be no way to compute an accurate number, according to Dr. Dewey M. Caron, a University of Delaware entomologist, but non-professional beekeepers are thought to own up to 10% of all bee colonies. Now, that may not sound significant, he says, but backyard beekeepers are some of the most active individuals in influencing legislators and policymakers. They serve a crucial part in maintaining bee populations. I had no eureka moment or activist manifesto. Over the years, I read about the bee's crucial role in pollination and therefore human survival, and slowly began daydreaming about lending them a spot to live. My idea of low-commitment community service, perhaps. I read a few beekeeper blog posts, fell into a YouTube rabbit hole, and took a weekend class. Once I was reasonably confident, I answered a call to adopt a hive. My bees were rescued in Silicon Valley, 50 miles south of where I live, the last block before the foggy city gives way to the Pacific Ocean. Having stealthily nested behind a boarded-up window in an abandoned house in Palo Alto, this colony was about to become homeless when developers decided to fix up the building. If ever there was a place for a joke about the Bay Area's ever-worsening housing shortage, this would be the punchline. Just in the nick of time, three volunteers went in to take apart the stalactite-like mass into sheets of waxy comb full of honey, bees, and soon-to-hatch babies, placing them into a Langstroth hive, a commonly used box to keep bees. My friend Cheryl Chang was one of the rescuers. Though master beekeepers spend their lifetime honing their skills, picking up the basics is less intimidating than most people might think. Cheryl has gone from a complete novice to being capable of capturing wayward swarms by dedicating a few hours a week over 2 short years to this hobby. In Mountain View, better known for tech giants like Google than bucolic pursuance, The philanthropic service professional keeps a tidy garden of avocados and pear trees, lemon, verbena, and pineapple guava bushes. Tucked in the corner by the fence, her two hives whir with activity year-round, producing gallons of honey more fragrant than anything I've bought from a store. As a matter of fact, some studies claim bees who forage for miles each day are healthier and plumper in cities and suburbs where they have access to diverse ecosystems offering a wider array of diet than monocultural farmland where there are only, say, bitter almond blossoms. In turn, this can yield to higher honey yields. But Cheryl's not in it for sweet nectar. "My beehives are like pets," she says as she helps me install the hives in my yard. "They're part of my family." Quite a statement for creatures you can't teach to roll over on command. And forget stroking them or snuggling up with them on the couch. I couldn't have understood her comment until now. As soon as we move the netting that keep the hives sealed for the car ride, dozens of bees spill out and hover around the hive's entrance, trying to take in their new environs. A few bees form a line on the landing strip of the entrance and start what could only be described as twerking. "They're fanning out the hive's scent," Cheryl tells me, "so the other bees from the colony can find their way back." Right away, I'm smitten. Then everything clicks in my head. I'm less a landlord or an amused Delante than a guardian. The responsibility for these lives suddenly weighs down on me. To stave off an imminent anxiety attack, I concentrate on what I've learned about bees. A few months back, I sat with about 30 people, mostly under 35, around a long table in a warehouse doubling as a classroom for San Francisco's honey and pollen. We were attending an introductory beekeeping class, and for most of us, the translucent comb being passed around was the first we'd touched of this marvelous geometric structure that bees build with their secretions. By trade, John McDonald retrofits homes for earthquakes, but he's also what the honey industry calls a sideliner, a part-time enthusiast who derives some income from keeping bees. He began keeping a few hives in the back of his lumber workshop as a hobby, and by 2006, he was selling honey and sharing the know-how he picked up. Now, he teaches upwards of 1,200 students a year. The surging popularity arrives at a critical juncture, as honeybees today have it harder than ever. Coming into public prominence in 2006, the massive disappearance of bees known as colony collapse disorder kills up to half of all hives in some areas, with some beekeepers reporting 90% of their stock perishing. But despite the urgency and the subsequent popularity of amateur beekeeping, only a select few actually pursue the hobby. "I'd say only about 1% of the attendees go on to start beekeeping," John said. Who were these curious onlookers spending their hard-earned day off in beekeeping suits? A couple next to me revealed that they were on a second date. A dyed-in-the-world Berkeley baby boomer declared, "We all should help bees save the world." Another woman confided that she was really just there for the honey tasting. Many had come from the sight of it to snap selfies in white overalls and black veils. For the next few hours, we got a crash course, part biology, part veterinary medicine, and part petting zoo. A colony, we learned, is led by one queen who takes to the sky only for a few days in her first spring in order to collect sperm and spends the rest of her years continuously laying eggs. Some of these eggs become drones or male bees whose sole purpose is to mate with a queen from a different hive and O cruel nature, immediately die. We'll continue this story in our next episode. This is Kay Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post. Good night.